The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Greetings, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his personal trainer, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 39 of The Big Picture for the week beginning November 22nd, and our third week on air. It's never going to get old.
It certainly will not get old, Mark. What's up on the show?
Okay, well, coming up, this episode, monsters out in the streets searching for reasonably priced takeaway. It's Hotel Transylvania 2.
There's also everyday greed and selling your soul for a roof over your head in the powerful drama 99 Homes.
And the long road for Katniss Everdeen finally comes to an end with Hunger Games 4. Or The Mockingjay Part 2, Scene 5001.
Yeah.
Unless they think of a sequel.
They're probably going to. Mate, good to see you. Third week on air.
Oh, I feel so much different.
Do you? You look different. You're looking great, though, third time round.
Well, I've been working out.
Yeah. Great for radio. Before we get to what the kids are going to be watching this week, Mark, we should do a quick wrap-up like we always do at the top of the show about what else is around this week.
News, news, news. Please cue the expensive sound effect. It's my grandfather, you know.
At cinemas this week, apart from some of the things that we're about to discuss in the show, is something we discussed on last week's show, Mark, The Program, the first feature film about Lance Armstrong. It's out at cinemas now. What you should do, if you didn't hear The Program last week, is go to thebigpicturewebsite.com and watch the video of us talking about The Program and how much I didn't quite get into Lance Armstrong, but I have my reasons.
Yeah, in fact, good reasons. Check them out.
Yep.
Have Australian viewers got room for another cooking show? Well, if you work at the Seven Network...
Is the answer yes?
The Seven Network kind of hopes so. Last Wednesday, they kicked off their new series, Aussie Barbecue Heroes, hosted by MKR's Texan cowboy Robert Murphy and celebrity chef Ben O'Donoghue. Well, can they find Australia's best barbecuer?
Yes!
You'd better hope so.
Right.
Or we're facing another six seasons of cooking, but outdoors. Yay! Check it out Wednesdays at 7:30 p.m. on the Seven Network.
Mate, there's not too much around that was exciting me on DVD and Blu-ray, which is why I've gone for a German movie called 13 Minutes, which I like this more than you did. I was really quite struck by this. It's based on a true story of a watchmaker who almost killed Hitler with a homemade bomb.
This is an almost story, people.
An almost story. But I was quite taken by just this remarkable piece of history and the massive question of what if this bloke had actually succeeded. 13 Minutes is out on DVD and Blu-ray.
Well, if you missed The Beautiful Lie in the ABC series, it's taken a modern take on Tolstoy's classic Anna Karenina, then you've got a second bite at the apple this week because The Beautiful Lie releases on Blu-ray and DVD this Wednesday. For those of you wondering whether following love wherever it takes you is the best policy, this is a cautionary taste well worth your effort.
Mark, I have some massive news this week that deserves this.
I'm regretting buying that.
And I'm really glad you're sitting down because we know there's Star Wars and Marvel franchises out there and they're trying to take over the universe and largely have been successful. Well, they've got a rival to the throne and that rival, Mark, is Fast and Furious. Fast and Furious is looking to franchise out, because there's already been seven, right? But they're looking to do spin-offs and prequels and other side characters from the Fast and Furious.
Because that's what I really
universe.
Need to know.
Okay, so producer and star of this, Vin Diesel, said, it's a very rich property. I'm trying to do this with a straight face.
There's no irony there. I believe he's actually making a monster.
And they're committed to treating it with a lot of, wait for it, class.
Sorry. Okay, well, next year will be quite busy for director Ridley Scott, as well as the Prometheus sequel, now renamed Alien Covenant. Unless you work for the Sydney Morning Herald, it's called Alien Convent for some reason. I have no idea. That actually got me interested. Anyway, he's also releasing Blade Runner 2 with Harrison Ford. That's fantastic news.
That's
incredible.
Hopefully it is.
This time, however, will not be in the dark, dirty, dystopian universe of Los Angeles, but Wyoming.
Okay. Wow, keep your eyes peeled. So that's what's happening in the new year. But what's happening this week and what your kids will be watching are about what we're going to talk about right now. Now, horror, you know, for kids, has become a boom industry in Hollywood the last couple of years. Hollywood's expansion around the world has led to the release of new pint-sized scary movies every October. But in Australia, we tend to push off those titles to closer to the December holidays. And so this week, parents get a chance to check their kids into creepy cartoon sequel Hotel Transylvania 2. So, of course, it's perfect for our What Your Kids Are Watching segment this week. So we've taken a look at Adam Sandler's reformed Count Dracula, who's now not the overprotective father. Instead, he's a pushy, success-driven grandfather.
Ever since Johnny and Mavis had their little monster, I've been the happiest vampire in the world!
Are we sure he's a vampire?
Technically, you have until you're 5 to get your vampire fangs.
Oh, he'll get his fangs. He's just like me. Look at him!
Blah, blah, blah.
I don't say blah, blah, blah.
We've been talking about moving somewhere safer for Dennis.
But then I'll be all alone.
Yeah, don't give me the pouty bat face.
Well, look, if you try to remember the plot line of Hotel Transylvania, basically the first one was Adam Sandler playing Drac, who's coming to terms with the fact that his daughter Mavis...
Doing the voice of, this is a cartoon for anyone who hasn't seen
He's not actually... it probably might have been a better film, to be honest with you. No,
don't give it away.
Yeah, anyway. His daughter Mavis is dating a human being, and so basically he's trying to come to terms with that. Well, we've moved on. Now they've actually got married, and they've had a kid, and they've got their young little kid, and they're wondering basically whether or not he's going to turn out to be a vampire. And so Drax got a lot invested in this because not only is it the family bloodline, see what I did there?
It's also the fact that
if he turns out to be a totally human, well, Mavis and hubby are going to move back to America and away from Transylvania. So everything is hanging on, making sure the little kid turns out to be the best vampire he can possibly be, whether he wants to or not.
Now, did you have those warning bells going off in your head when you heard Adam Sandler comedy and family fun joined together in the same sentence, the same description of a movie? It doesn't always sound like the best pick. So is this safe viewing, actually, for all ages?
Adam Sandler, for me, is not territory you would normally take your kids in, okay, because it's very adult humor, but basically it's safe stuff. You know, he's been neutered. That's basically they're taking out all the bad stuff.
That's
it's
a mental picture I'd never ever wanted in my mind. I'm trying
Welcome
to push
to
it
radio.
Out now. So in this movie there's a lot of focus on Dracula, I take it, on Adam Sandler's character. Are all the problems on Dracula's side of things? So is this more a movie for parents or for the kids, then, if it's all focusing on Dracula?
Yeah, that's one of the problems of the film. Look, kids are going to enjoy this. I actually took 2 of my boys to this, and whether it was the free popcorn or not, I don't know, but they had a great time, and they talked about the film afterwards. But this is largely a film all about Drac, who is the parent figure. He's the central character. And so the kid, who the kids would probably tend to sort of identify with, is really not actually center. And that's, I think, one of the problems. But then having said that, one of the big issues is they're trying to say to parents, basically, listen, you shouldn't be so pushy with your children.
Okay, I'm going to ask you more about the pushy direction stuff. But before I do, monsters in a movie taking your kids to, how concerned should we be about doing that?
There's nothing monstrous about them. That's the weird thing. In fact, all of the characters have moved on, so like the mummy... Has got so old, so to speak, he can't remember half his magic anymore. And the werewolf has turned into a vegetarian. And, since all this stuff is like...
So it's like the least scary Halloween party you've ever heard of.
Yeah, in fact, if anything, the premises have kind of fallen over. It's like, you know...
So they may not even necessarily have... They don't have to be monsters, is what you're saying.
No, not at all.
They could have just been anything. It could have been a collection of friends hanging out at the farm.
Migrant workers with funny voices. Literally accents. That's all it is.
Right. Now, go back to this bit about... not pushing kids in any direction. So is that the moral of the story? Is that what you take away from Hotel Transylvania 2? I don't know what you'd be expecting going into Hotel Transylvania 2 to come out with. Like, what kind of message would that movie be giving
you? If the first film was about, you know, let love go where it will.
Of course.
Okay. Then the second film is about let kids grow up to be whoever they want to be.
Right.
Now, ostensibly, I don't have a problem with that. Okay. At the basic level, you want a kid's personality to emerge, to be the person that God's designed them to be. That is not a problem, okay? But there is a bit of a spirit of the age when it comes to parenting to basically say, let a child find their own way. Water will find its way. Let it flow downhill. It'll all work out. And that's not exactly true, okay? Because children come into this world knowing nit about the world. They know nothing. And so they need to be. In fact, the Bible actually says that what you're supposed to do is train a child. Look, interesting little side point about the Bible. A recent translation of the NIV actually has this line, Proverbs 22:6, start children off on the way they should go, and they will not leave it when they're old. Okay? Which is a real, I think, nod to how parenting is apparently going these days. Because the original translation, or at least from the you know, King James Version was train up a child in the way that they should go.
There's a massive difference
between starting someone off and just saying, seeing how they go, and train up. Whereas the Bible's emphasis has always been, parents, you're actually there for a reason.
Yes.
You've got a responsibility. So, look, the kids
are going
to... You
have the wisdom, you have the experience. Yeah. You can assist your child in making their way in the world.
Yeah, and I'm not worried about the effect on kids in this one. They'll just have fun. But parents, it's your job to put the hard yards in. And so never feel ashamed that you actually say no, or never feel ashamed that you actually say we're going... No child is ever going to thank you when you say, turn off the TV, it's time for church. You know, you're actually training them, and that's well worth doing.
If you want to go check out Hotel Transylvania 2, it is playing all around the place from this Thursday, November 26. Rated PG for mild animated violence. Some scary scenes, as you can imagine, given it's called Hotel Transylvania 2. It stars the vocal talents of Adam Sandler, Selena Gomez, Nick Offerman, and Steve Buscemi.
Sure. And listen, while we're on the topic of hotels, let me point you towards the current edition of Eternity. The November edition is actually out in churches. It's worth checking out an article this week because the newspaper talks about a couple who have actually bought a hotel in northern South Australia, in fact, north of Adelaide, so that they can actually turn it into a place, you know, that is welcoming to people who are outcast in their community. I think this is a brilliant thing. It's like taking something, that a building that might have actually been at the source of trouble for years, and turn it into a beacon of hope. Well, why wouldn't you love that? So read that. Eternity November, it's in the stands in your church now.
Stick around with The Big Picture, because still to come, one of the best movies I've seen this year, hands down, that's coming up. And also top five about the people I would love to share the end of the world with.
Welcome back to the show. This week, we're looking at soundtrack again, and soundtrack's particular pick is from a horror-themed musical film, kind of picking up on our Transylvania 2, Hotel Transylvania 2 thing, and an equally creepy stage musical. It was also in I'm Sorry the Bridge Is Out, You'll Have to Spend the Night. One I'd love to buy a ticket to if only to see it.
Catchy.
There's a title. It's by Bobby Boris Pickett, and it's guaranteed to take you straight back to primary school performances and after-school discos.
I was working in the lab late one night when my beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise, he did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
Wow.
From my laboratory in the castle east,
wow,
to the master bedroom where the vampires feast.
Wow. Wow.
The ghouls all came from their humble abodes,
wow,
to get a jolt from my electrodes.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
Wow.
The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun. The guests included Wolfman, Dracula, and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five. They played the monster mash. It was a graveyard smash. It caught on in a flash.
They played the
monster mash. Out from his coffin, Drax's voice did ring. Seems he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. And it's a graveyard smash. It's caught on in a flash.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
Wow.
Now everything's cool, Drax a part of the band.
Wow.
And my monster mash is the hit of the land.
Wow.
For you, the living, this mash was meant to.
Wow.
When you get to my door, tell them Boris sent
you.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
The Monster Mash features in Monster Mash, the movie. No real surprise there.
There's also
a
movie?
There's a movie. It actually features in two films. The second one, called Frankenstein Sings. Okay, obviously a big hit, which starred Pickett himself as Dr. Frankenstein. Here's the plot line. Tell me if this sounds familiar. A teenage couple, Mary and Scott, are on their way home from a Halloween party when car trouble prompts them to seek help at the old mansion of Dr. Frankenstein. Once inside, they meet a host of strange characters at whose mercy Scott and Mary suddenly find themselves when Frankenstein informs them, "I'm sorry, the bridge is out. You'll have to spend the night." Yeah, it's
isn't that the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
This was the precursor to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The Rocky Horror Picture Show is a spoof of Frankenstein Sings.
Dear.
I know, so there you
goodness
go.
Me,
and in Monster Mash, each character has his or her own secret designs on Marion Scott, just like in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Frankenstein wants to take out Scott's brain and put it in his latest creation. Meanwhile, Frankenstein's assistant Igor develops feelings for Mary, especially after she encourages him to be confident and play your hunch. Okay. Well, look, that's our choice for this week. Now, the global financial crisis wasn't that long ago, and to be honest, you and your family might still be trying to recover from it. I know I am. And the US drama 99 Homes is set just after the GFC hits. And in particular, it picks up on the story of thousands of American families who lost their homes. In particular, it presents what one man will do to get his family home back. By all accounts, it's a moving, realistic portrait of the ongoing cost of selling your soul.
You kicked me out yesterday.
I didn't kick you out. The bank did. Did you do construction? I'll pay $50 cash.
Are you kidding me?
$50 shouldn't be a joke to you, son.
What are you doing with him? I gotta work, you know?
Because I want my home back.
Don't get emotional about real estate.
That's my family home.
If you want it.
I need to know that I have someone who can handle any situation 24/7.
Are you putting notices on my window?
When you work for me, you're mine.
This is serious money.
Do you want to double what you made?
Are we stealing? Is this stealing?
Feels a bit like trouble.
What'd you think it was going to mean working for me?
Mark, I'm going to have a lot of difficulty in the next couple of minutes not going on about this movie in a very, very positive way in terms of like trying to contain my enthusiasm for how good this film is.
Gush away.
I'm about to gush. So 99 Homes focuses on this guy called Dennis, played by Andrew Garfield, who I think is best known for Social Network and The Amazing Spider-Man. And he's a guy living in Florida, everyday guy. And he's working on construction sites, gets kicked off that job. And in the first couple of minutes, you see the repercussions of that, which boil down to him being evicted from his family home that he can no longer pay for. And the courts decide, mate, you're done. Like, you can't meet your repayments, you're out. And then we meet this other character called Rick Carver, who's played by Michael Shannon, who I think listeners probably know him from TV series like Boardwalk Empire or maybe Man of Steel. He was in that as well. And Rick Carver is this real estate guy who has moved from selling homes to basically repossessing homes and then on-selling them for more money. So he's the kind of guy that made money out of the GFC. And across 99 Homes, you see Dennis, Andrew Garfield's character, get involved with Rick Carver, even though he was the guy who kicked him out of his home the day before. But you see Dennis come to work for Rick and the impact that that has and his home life.
You work for the devil.
Well, it's more sophisticated and more complicated than that. And that's one of the many things I liked about 99 Homes.
This does not sound like a date night film.
No.
I mean, you're saying Maya saying, oh, it's a long day. Haven't we settled down? Yeah, let's watch 99 Homes. No,
it's like one of those kind of movies that I think, unfortunately, a lot of people aren't going to go see, because who wants to go out and see this GFC movie about this guy losing his home and selling his soul to the devil and watching what happens as a result? But as much as it's not a feel-good date night movie, it's like it just isn't. It's not intending to be so. But it's a fantastic piece of work if you want to watch people in a situation and determining what they're going to do in that. And it's so realistic and credible. One of the great things about 99 Homes that I was very struck by is, you know, you're watching a movie, like, you know, it's still a story. But particularly Andrew Garfield as Dennis does a fantastic job, often with not too much to say. But the look on his face and the situation that he's in, what he does as he starts working for Rick Carver and the kind of the dodgier deals that he starts getting into. He doesn't even need to explain to you how he's feeling, what's going on. You actually kind of understand this bloke. Even if you don't agree with the choices he's making, you understand him. Really, I should just say up front, I don't have much that I didn't like about this movie. And one of the many good things about this movie is Rick Carver's character. Michael Shannon plays him great. He's just a great businessman, salesman. Some of the sales pitches he comes out with and the explanations for what he does are just incredible. But he's not as big a villain as you might think. This isn't a movie after the GFC that's trying to bash people that made money out of the GFC. You can make your own judgment about that as a viewer, about whether you think they should have done what they did. But a lot of what they do is legal. Like what the job Rick Carver has, the business he has, isn't illegal. And they do get involved with illegal things, Rick and Dennis, increasingly so. But the villain here, I don't think, is people who made money necessarily. The villain is more in yourself, in a person in a situation making one choice that could lead them down a certain path, that they make the choice and then they start running in the wrong direction and they don't stop themselves from doing that. I think 99 Homes is more of a portrait of the villain in all of us, where we can just get led off onto the wrong path and then not pull ourselves up as we're on it.
Dennis, could he have done anything else? There's lots of people who sort of say, this was the only choice I had. It was important I keep my home, so I took this line of work. Do you really have no choice?
I don't think so. And as much as Dennis seems to hold to that in the movie, not in such a self-righteous way that you can get in a lot of other movies where people really dig in and try to justify everything they do. As much as he seems that he doesn't have a choice initially, he's out of work. He gets offered this job from Rick Carver and becomes enmeshed in his business operations.
In his little world, yeah.
It's very tantalizing to have this money and this legal job. But as you watch Dennis get more involved with this, he starts doing to others what was done to him. And as much as, again, a lot of it's legal, he still is like, you can clearly see he's torn up about this. But the longer the film goes along, he seems to just make excuses for what he's doing based on the fact that he can get his own home back for his family. And you think about teachings of Jesus in contrast to that, about doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. And 99 Homes almost plays out as a fable demonstrating this, that if you don't look to do for others as you would have them do to you, the impact upon yourself, let alone the community around you, is just extraordinary. So there are so many links in 99 Homes to Christian teaching and beliefs and principles. I could bang on for hours about it, but I was very struck by everything from this movie sort of suggesting don't put all your focus and value on wealth, like storing all of that, to also just thinking through your moral convictions and your moral compass. If you don't bring it to the fore and think it through as you make decisions, you, like Dennis in this movie, could just get led off in the wrong direction and find that your soul gets corrupted and destroyed by the choices you're making. 99 Homes, Mark, is so great.
Well, the 99 Homes edition of The Big Picture, which is an hour-long
one. Can I talk more about
99 Homes?
We'll
actually be done next week. Maybe it'll be a special feature available at our website. 99 Homes is now showing at cinemas around the country. It stars Andrew Garfield, Michael Shannon, and Laura Dern. It's rated M for coarse language and mature themes. And just as an aside, my wife and I tried to get into this at the Sydney Film Festival. It was sold out. So it does sound like it's a great film.
Ah, fantastic piece of work. Now, Mark, we're not sellouts. Instead, we're just...
no one's offered us enough money yet.
But if
you'd like to contact us at tellthebigpicture@gmail.com and ask us to sell out, please.
But if you'd like to sell us and shop us around for free, you can do that because we're online. My goodness, we're online. We're not just on air. We're not just on podcast. That's online. Everywhere. And so don't be shy. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Don't just keep us to yourselves. Instead, let everyone know about the podcasts and videos that we're creating as we bring a Christian insight into popular culture. So find us on Facebook and Twitter and then tell every single person ever about it.
Coming up, The Mockingjay, finally, for her final performance on the big screen, let's hope. And also, we have top five films that Ben basically says he wishes... top five people he'd like to have with him at the end of the world.
Welcome back. Now, coming up, we are going to talk about the biggest film release around... Everyone knows what it is. I'm trying to be suspenseful and mysterious. It's The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 2. We are going to talk about it. But before we do, Mark...
Yes, before we do, we're actually going to talk about press record. Now, press record's one of those seconds we have where we take the digital recorder out and chat to people about their thoughts on film. Let me begin by describing it this way. Recently, I published my first novel. Now...
I was waiting for when you get to that segment in the show where you talk about your novel.
I say this not to promote that book in particular, though it is reasonably priced and available,
and
via my website. But because the first thing the publisher asked me when I was writing this book was, are you writing another one? And I was like, will it be set in a dystopian landscape where teens battle against all odds for survival?
And I was thinking,
and she came back, how about a strong female character with a bow, and can it have three sequels? Dystopian fiction is more than the flavour of the month when it comes to young adult audiences. It's the expectation, and our young readers are lapping up everything apocalyptic in sight. What's got into their heads? Are they looking forward to the end of society as we know it? I caught up with a posse of teens this week and put the question to them. So I'm sitting here with the target market for The Hunger Games, like teens who are apparently in love with this sort of dystopian future. Guys, who's actually read some of The Hunger Games books? Anyone?
I've read all the books.
What did you like about them?
The storylines that would never happen in like real life, but still interesting to read and find out what would happen if it was like that in real life.
And because you wanted to be Katniss Everdeen?
I don't think I'd like going in The Hunger Games.
Has anybody else read The Hunger Games?
Oh, yeah. I have. I really enjoy that style of book because I think the idea of relating to someone who's our age, who's saved the whole country from going to ashes, that's a really cool idea. And while I could probably never do that, it's nice to read about it and imagine you're kind of doing the same thing.
Now, it's not just a girl thing. You've read it too. Like, you like The Hunger Games. What did you like about it?
Oh, yeah. I read all the books mainly because the characters struggle through and overcome all of their problems in the books. And I think, like, yeah, that's nice to be able to do what you go out to achieve, yeah.
Now, it's not just The Hunger Games. There's lots of different stories like this. You've got the Divergent series and you've got Maze Runner. Any of you guys seen any of the films or read those books?
Yeah, I've read 1.5 of the Maze Runner books, and I've seen both of the movies that have come out. And I think the reason I like it is more because it is actually realistic, the Maze Runner trilogy.
Hang on a second, aren't they trapped in a huge maze? Help me out here.
That's only the first one, but the second one is much more realistic.
Oh, the one where they're in the massive desert with this scorched disease that's killing everybody? Yeah, okay, sorry.
Well, okay. Realistic as it could be, but pretty much it's realistic because when problems come up, they don't immediately just overcome it because they're the main heroes. People, like half of the members in the first book all die, and then another 10 die in the second book. So they don't always all get through just because they're the main characters sort of thing.
Right, cool. Well, what about the Divergent, Insurgent, Detergent series? That seems to be pretty popular.
I really like that series as well. But I think what really appeals to me, I think for that one, it would be the emotion that is in the story because there's a lot of family attachment and there's definitely some romance and people die. And I think, okay, that sounds a bit morbid, but I really enjoy reading emotional scenes like that and they appeal to me, so.
No, that's good. So it's not so much about the end of the world so much as how people react at the end of the world and the choices they make. Is that right?
Divergent's not really about the end of the world, but rather it's about a girl who's trying to save the experiment that her world is turning into.
Now, I know you guys, not all of you have read the books or not all of you have seen the films, it's all different things, but you're kind of interested in this idea of teens taking control of their lives. What do you particularly like about it?
Well, I like seeing how, even though if it's to do with Greek gods or things that we don't believe in as Christians, but I like comparing it from the Christian world to the Greek world or the pagan world.
So you like to imagine, like, as a Christian, what you would do in that circumstance or how you behave?
Yeah, and just comparing the different beliefs as well.
I like them because it's the choice that people make again, and also the action sometimes and how people, like, feel about each other and, like, what they would do and what I would do as well.
You get to choose which sort of person you're going to be. Is that what you think? It's about choice?
Yeah, and also your morals, like the Hunger Games. Is it wrong to kill someone else if they're going to kill you? And discovering your morals and the characters' morals too. And, yeah, right and wrong.
Hey, last thing, you're all going to be lining up to see Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2 when it comes out?
Definitely, we're already planning to see it together.
I haven't seen the first three, so maybe.
You've been spared, trust me. I'm sorry.
Mark, I think in that segment you had a go at a couple of kids.
Look, one of my pastimes is teenage baiting, just in case. It's a sport I thoroughly recommend. There's equipment for it. You know, there will be a website, I'm sure.
In case that segment didn't tell you, and in case you somehow missed the memo, the Hunger Games franchise has become a worldwide phenomenon. It's got an almost fanatical fan base, 3 best-selling books, and 4 blockbuster films. Last Thursday, Mockingjay Part 2, the final film in this Hunger Games saga, opened at Australian cinemas. Mockingjay Part 1 rustled up, like a cool $1 billion at box office worldwide, and you can expect Part 2 will be looking to do exactly the same. Mark has seen the Hunger Games finale, and he discovered it's a send-off that understands there's no easy way to end a war.
We got one shot.
Let's make it count.
Nothing good is safe while he's alive. Snow has to pay for what he's done.
Our lives were never ours. They belong to Snow, and our deaths do too. But if you kill him, Katniss, if you end all of this, all those deaths, they mean something.
This is definitely a film you're going to need some form of abridged form of what came before with. Okay, because
you need to understand what came
you
before.
Do, you yes. do, because it just starts straight away like it's in the middle of a plot. Okay, so in the first Hunger Games, Katniss Everdeen survives this brutal gladiatorial games, okay, with square-jawed Peter alongside. And in the second film, Catching Fire, she pretty much does it again, but this time she escapes the system. However, Peter gets left behind, and she gets off to the rebels in District 13. And basically, in this time, we start Mockingjay Part 2, almost a couple of days after the fact that Katniss has just rescued Peter at the end of the Part 1 film, and he's tried to kill her straight away. And so she's still massaging her neck when the film opens. So unless you know what's going on before, it's a bit of a weirdo one. Look, our heroine realizes the only real way to end this protracted civil war is to solve it at the source, to kill President Snow. So she heads off on an assassination mission. But the question is, in the end, is she going to have what it takes to take President Snow out?
Now, does this movie have what it takes, Mark? Because we've had a Hunger Games movie every year for 4 years. We've finally come to the end of the whole thing. Was it worth it?
Well, to be honest, I valued the closure. Okay. Yeah. Now, I want to be honest. Look, I've read all of the books, and I think, in some respects, you know, there's some really fantastic things in it. Like, the first book was fantastic. The Hunger Games book was fantastic. And the first film was fantastic.
It was. Yeah, I really liked that film.
Great stuff. And like the books, the films do tend to tail off a bit. There's some great high-tension moments in it. There's a fantastic underground scene that just keeps you on the edge of your seat. So it's a good film, but it is one for the fans, I think.
And what are they going to get out of it? So you mentioned, yeah, anyone who's not really down with the Hunger Games might be a little bit shrugging their shoulders or scorning or mocking or whatever they might do.
Mockingjay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But what about this massive fan base and the teams we just heard from some of them then? What do you reckon they'll take away from it?
One of the clearest things they're going to get out of this is that there's just no easy way to end a war. So, like, as the film draws to a close, and I don't want to take anything out, yes, okay, everybody knows that the good guys are going to win in the end, but what sort of victory is it? People are still broken, still damaged. If you think about it, there's a whole cycle in the Hunger Games. Katniss Everdeen, in the first film, set out to save her sister. You know, she substituted herself when her sister was chosen for these gladiatorial games. She set out to save her sister. She comes full circle, and what has she managed to save in the end? Now, I won't give it away, but the truth is, she walks away pretty empty-handed.
I was quite struck in the press record segment that so many readers of the books did take what was happening on the pages of The Hunger Games and thought about them in real-life situations. And given we are in a world that seems to be at war often and always, and thankfully in Australia we aren't as affected by it, but we are in a world that's constantly at war, do you think The Hunger Games actually offers a solution to how we could stop war, or stop being war weary?
Look, it certainly tries to do so. It comes out with a very strong message at the end, which is basically to say, you can't get past the bad things, and the bad things might be with you forever. Now, that's just intelligent, and that's something that teens have got to hear. There is no easy mix. In fact, parents, adults should understand that conflicts that we involve ourselves in will have implications for the rest of our lives. So they say at the end of the film, in fact, Katniss actually tells us, this is how you get past it. you count your blessings. I think this is wise thinking. Psychologists have found that people who actually learn to say thank you on a daily basis for what they have enjoyed are much better built up emotionally to take care of themselves in the coming months and years and crises that might come across them. And I think that's brilliant advice to give to teens. Listen, you might not be able to change the bad stuff, but stop for a moment and tally up the good stuff. That said, when you start thinking about all the good things you've been given, I think you do yourself a disservice if you stop short and don't realize that there's a giver. Okay, this is the problem with, I guess the modern world wants to think in terms of, yeah, that was great, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this, but who gave you that? You're actually cutting yourself off from half the gift when you ignore the fact that someone is standing behind it giving it. From a Christian perspective, I want people not only to count their blessings, I want to look at the person who's blessing them. So guys, if you're actually going to pick up this habit of saying, this is how I deal with my day, I'm going to say thank you for the things I got at the end of the day, remember who you're thanking. That's well worth your effort.
Great point. The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2 is now showing everywhere. It stars Jennifer Lawrence, Josh Hutcherson, Australia's Liam Hemsworth, and loads of other famous faces. It is rated M for mature themes, violence, and horror sequences. What I should add is that if you want another voice, another opinion, Mark's was particularly...
Yeah, mine's okay.
Mark's was particularly
there
great.
There might be a better one.
But if you want to weigh up his opinion against another Christian reviewer who also has deeply thought about this, check out Russ Matthews' review of Hunger Games 4. Are we calling it that now, Hunger Games 4?
I sat next to Russ during this, and I just want to say he wept the whole way through.
If you want to see a gushing, weepy review, go to insights.uca.org.au and check out Russ Matthews' review.
Coming up on the show yet, we're still to hear from Ben, who's going to tell us the top five people he'd like to share the end of the world with, and we'll also be telling you about great things coming up in the week to come.
Welcome back to the show. Now, on a regular basis, the world can feel like it's coming to an end, and that's not just when you turn on the news or you see reports of horrible events around the world. We just talked about Mockingjay Part 2, which is all about the world coming to an end, and there's all these TV shows that are constantly telling us there's a war or a virus or a natural disaster.
So relax.
Or some other
it's
catastrophe.
All going down.
So relax, because everything that we know is about to be blown up. Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark has bravely this week ventured to the brink of existence for all of us to let us know what the Bible has to say about the end of the world.
The seventh angel sounded his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven which said, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and his Messiah, and he will reign forever and ever." I do love that verse, Revelation chapter 11, verse 15, and I wish I'd read it with more understanding as a teenager. But at that point, I was dwelling on the idea that the world will come to an end. I grew up in the age of nuclear armament, when as teenagers we expected that any day now someone would push a button and the whole planet would go sky high. We saw horrific images of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we listened to Helen Caldicott and others when she explained the agony caused by nuclear radiation. And we listened to Barry Maguire singing that we were on the eve of destruction. Well, that probably dates me with many listeners, but it struck me, as the father of teenagers, that they are going through a similar anxiety to the one that kept me awake at night. With talk about environmental disaster, with dreadful war and conflict in the Middle East and elsewhere, this generation is growing up with the same mood of imminent doom. The idea that the world could end soon isn't a hard one to flesh out in your imagination. We can see how it would happen. Well, the Bible also provides us with several notions to consider about the end of the world. There are many images in the Bible of large-scale destruction in language used both in the Old Testaments and New Testaments to describe God's judgment. For example, the cosmic flood of Genesis is echoed in the cosmic fire of 2 Peter. These are all images to drum into our thick heads that God will judge the world. Judgment is coming for those who oppose the justice of God, and it's going to be awful, apocalyptic even. But beyond that judgment, for those who seek first God and his kingdom and humble themselves before him, seeking forgiveness and mercy, there is great hope that the end of the world is actually a new beginning. In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the Earth is blown up to make way for an interplanetary bypass. All-powerful though he is, Yahweh, the God of Israel, the Father of Jesus Christ, has no such plans. He does not plan to destroy the Earth. The earth is in fact his and everything in it. It's the creation he loved at the beginning and still loves now and always. The Bible confirms for us that God will judge the world, not that he will end it. Our God has bigger, better, more beautiful plans for planet Earth. He's going to renew it and reign over it as Lord.
Mark, we're coming to the end of the program.
And not
week.
The end of the world.
And not the end of the world.
Something close to it.
And yet we're continually talking about the end of the world.
But you particularly have had the end of the world in your brain. You've been considering a particular question for us.
I have. So for our top five list this week, thought, who would be movie people I'd like to share the end of the world with?
Five.
I was thinking if the world was going to come to an end, you'd like someone who has the ability to somehow not be around when the world ends and be able to take you off, I don't know, let's say to another world, like in Tomorrowland that was out this year.
Oh, okay.
Where all these people running around the world who have these buttons that have got a T on them. This is what you should do when the world's about to end. You should look for a person who has a button that has T on it and stick with that person. Make really good friends with them, like Casey or George Clooney, as a case maybe. Just look for George Clooney when the world's going
to
end.
That's what you've got to do. When the world ends, find George
Clooney.
Because
he has one of these pins and he will be able to whisk you off to safety in this other dimension that was at sort of at the core. Tomorrowland is this other dimension that was where people, really smart people, were going because the world was coming to an end, and they thought, well, we don't want to be part of that and go down with all the stupid people, so instead we just want to go to another dimension where everyone's smart.
It was a tad elitist.
Just a little bit. It really struck me as a really sensible idea.
Good realistic advice to begin our top five.
Four.
If the world was about to end, Mark, I thought it'd be really good to hang out with your mates. I wouldn't mind partying with my mates in New York, which is what happened in Cloverfield in 2008.
Oh, now, just before the monster ate everyone.
Just before this massive monster smashed into New York and started just destroying the place. And presumably, although we don't really see it in the movie, he was going to take down the rest of the planet. Come on, whatever that thing was.
No monster that starts with New York as an appetizer is going to be satisfied with that.
No, exactly right. Now, I'm not just raising Cloverfield because I had one of my review quotes put on the front cover of Cloverfield years ago, Mark, which I'm sure you've seen on the DVD and the Blu-ray as you've longingly looked at the front cover of Cloverfield.
I have. Now, was that you or one of your pseudo-identities?
One of my other names that I write
Victoria
under. This is a true story. I do sometimes
like
write under other names. I can't go into the reasons why or death may come upon me, but I appear on the Juno cover as well of the DVD with my actual name, Ben McKechnie, and then one of the names that I write under, Zach Gibson, because I wrote two separate reviews for two different publications. That was so great that they both made it to the back cover of Juno.
The entire success of Juno is attributed to one person.
Getting back to Cloverfield and the point, I really like the idea that these mates are partying in New York and hanging out. And sure, they didn't know the end of the world was coming either, but they banded together. They didn't split up. They banded together and tried to save themselves from that. I think that's a pretty good way to go out.
Three.
I was thinking about an actor or actress that has come up against the end of the world on a bunch of different occasions, thinking, you know, if you're going to pick someone from movies that you want to share the end of the world with, you should really pick someone...
Someone with a bit of experience.
Particularly someone who survived.
Oh,
right?
Okay, yeah.
And so most disaster movies, the hero does tend to survive. And I was thinking about people like Will Smith. He's come up against... he was in Independence Day.
Yeah.
But instead, I thought, nah, I'd actually really like to hang out with Kevin Costner, because that dude has survived the end of the world not just once, but twice.
Okay.
In Waterworld, you remember Waterworld
of
from 1995. And Kevin Costner was really like batting quite well in movie stakes, everything from
Dancing
with Wolves and Untouchables and JFK. He was doing very nicely. And then Waterworld came out and sunk. And that mainly because there was loads of money tipped into that movie, a couple of like $100 million, and it made, you know, like $5 at the cinema. Most people didn't like the movie, but it's actually better than it sounds. And people, I think, should go and check it out. Because in Waterworld, as it sounds, like Noah and the flood comes and demolishes all the world, everyone lives on the water, and Kevin Costner has somehow survived that event. Then 2 years later, not only did he survive the event of Waterworld, the movie not doing very well, he turned up in The Postman in 1997, which also is post-apocalyptic this time. He's playing, as the title suggests, a guy bringing the mail in the future, because that's the most important thing you'd want to do after surviving the world is bring the post.
Two.
But a lot closer to home, your wife and children, or husband and children. Insert family into this pick, Mark, at number two.
I'm just wondering, actually, if you've got your family and your wife at number two. Now, look, we'll get on to number one in a second.
I like how you're thinking ahead. There are a number of choices could have made. Movies like Signs, that Mel Gibson film, War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise. But I went with a movie that links back to earlier in the show. A guy called Michael Shannon, who was in 99 Homes, was in a film in 2011 called Take Shelter, which is a little scene film, but it's quite an amazing movie. It's like a disaster movie, more like an art house film. So it focuses on the people at the center of it rather than explosions and that kind of stuff. And this character that Michael Shannon's playing is effectively like a modern-day Noah, where he thinks in visions and dreams he's being told the world is about to end. And instead of building an ark, he builds a bunker. And as much as his wife, who's played by Jessica Chastain, who was in The Martian and Interstellar, Jessica Chastain thinks he's like freaked out and lost his mind and doesn't really know what to do with this. But their daughter seems to understand what Dad's on about. But I really liked Take Shelter, the sort of central message of a guy not just picking up on a vision of the end of the world and trying to prepare for it, but trying to prepare for that and his family and to look after his family as well. I think most people, if you were actually confronted with the real life scenario of the world coming to an end, you would try to get your loved ones around you. And Take Shelter really catches that nicely in this quite creepy, evocative end of the world movie.
One.
Jesus. I would like to be with Jesus when the world comes to an end. Whatever shape or form that's going to look like when things sort of collapse all around you, I want to be by the side of Jesus. I don't care about Tomorrowland pins as much. Even Kevin Costner. I mean, he can be there if he wants to be.
That'd be nice.
But who I'll be going in search of? Nice, who will be going in search of is Jesus. Now, most of the Jesus movies up on screen, everything from The Passion of the Christ to The Greatest Story Ever Told to the Jesus movie or The Son of God more recently, don't really depict what will happen at the end of times. And the end of times is mentioned a lot in the Bible, as Greg Clark was talking about. There is going to be some massive change coming. That's what God's told us through his word, that's going to happen. So whenever this event actually happens, what we're also told is that when it does go down, Jesus is going to be leading the way. He's the savior of the world and he's the only hope of getting onto whatever is coming next. So I just think about the verses all the way through the Bible that talk about this, but really giving your life over to Jesus and you will be with him in whatever this new existence is. That is the guy I would like to share the end of the world with. Now, I couldn't really get a Jesus end of the world clip, so instead I'm just going to play a clip from Son of God just to hear a bit of an actor saying stuff like Jesus.
How did this happen?
Come with me.
What are we going to do?
Change the world. Your sins are forgiven, my son.
I thought only God could do that.
Which is easier, to say his sins are forgiven, or say he get up and walk?
I've had reports of a young prophet of Nazareth. It's rumored he works miracles.
They all do.
Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God.
Pray to him, and he will listen.
5,000 came to see him. 5,000.
Yeah, future with Jesus, no dystopian future. Well, listen, coming up next week,
mate, we've got so much coming. We've got Ant-Man and other godlike superpowers in a new film, Absolutely Anything.
Actually, we also make an early prediction of Oscar success.
Well, we are going out early.
We're talking about Cate Blanchett's Carol.
And we're also going to be talking about a family-friendly monster movie and the top five monster movies that did not scare Mark Hadley. Next week, just like this week, I will still be Ben McKecken.
And I'll be Mark Hadley. See ya.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.